Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Listening to another episode of Lords of Limited with your hosts Ben Wernie and Ethan Sachs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Wernie, and joining me on the line is Ethan Sachs. I think we got a good one this evening, Ethan.
Yeah, I definitely think we got a good one. I'm so happy to be reunited with you, my friend.
I know, it's been a couple weeks.
I know, I missed you last week.
I checked out your episode, though, on Men from Moto, and it was very, very good. You guys crushed it analyzing Huey's draft.
Thank you. Likewise, I really enjoyed your episode with Travis. It was very cool to get to download an episode of my own podcast and have it be a surprise.
Yeah, it's super cool. Yeah. So we've got a good one here. The episode this week is how to draft and win in Ixalan. I think a lot of people have been struggling in this format. You and I both initially, certainly, and I think we finally turned the corner.
Yeah, for sure. This was a rough start for this format for me especially, and I feel really confident in the past 2 weeks about my approach to this format.
Yeah, so should we check in on the trophy leaderboard?
I think we should. You are destroying it, my friend.
Yeah, I've had a pretty good run here the last couple weeks. I've done 59 drafts, have 21 trophies, so trophying a little more than one in three drafts. Have a 125-52 overall record for a 70.6% win rate, which I'm going to round up to 71%.
Attaboy. So I have a lot more drafts under my belt, almost twice as many. I'm at 93 drafts with 27 trophies. So I've made, I think I'm about 7th place on the trophy leaderboard right now.
Heck yeah, you are.
My win rate is 173-96, which is 64%. But I looked at my first half of my drafts and my second half of my drafts. I was 58% win rate in the first half of my drafts and 69% in the second half. So just feel like I burned through a lot of drafts when I didn't really know what was going on, and now I feel like I've hit my stride.
And I think what we're going to lay out here in the episode for you tonight is what is attributing to your increasing win rate, I would think.
Yes, for sure.
So yeah, if you're struggling with this format and you want to know how a way to win, there might be others, but this is how Ethan and I are approaching the format. Strap your seatbelts in, and without further ado, I think we should take a seat at the round table.
Let's do it, man. Let's get down in there.
Okay, we've got our first pack here, and cards in contention include Skyblade of the Legion, 1 and a white for a 1/3 flying vampire soldier, Headstrong Brute, 2 and a red for a 3/3 orc pirate. Headstrong Brute can't block, and it has menace as long as you control another pirate. Deeproot Warrior, 1 and a green for the 2/2 merfolk warrior, and when it becomes blocked, it gets +1/+1 until end of turn. Steadfast Armosaur, that's 3 and a white for the 2/3 dinosaur with vigilance, and it's got the activated ability 1 and a white tap. Steadfast Armosaur deals damage equal to its toughness to target creature blocking or being blocked by it. Bonded Horncrest, 3 and a red for the 5/5 dinosaur that can't attack or block alone.
So I feel like maybe at the start of the format I would have taken Bonded Horncrest just because it's a big beefy thing. People were pretty excited about dinosaurs at the start of the format. 4 mana for a 5/5 is an incredible rate. Can't attack or block alone is not that big of a drawback, especially as a 4 mana slot. But as we'll get into, in the episode today, you and I are both really high on 2-drops, especially efficient 2-drops that scale well with the game, and Deeproot Warrior does that fantastically. 2 mana for a 2/2 that can attack as a 3/3 when it gets blocked basically is going to trade with almost every common in the format, so I'm pretty excited about grabbing that here. What do you think?
I think so too. That is what I first picked, and I wasn't thrilled about it. I think, you know, as we'll get into later in the episode, I think we're both trying to avoid green a little bit, so I took this first, and I think if you're green, you really want to be Merfolk, maybe Dinosaurs if you get some Savage Stomps or some Drovers of the Mighty, something along those lines. But mostly if I'm green, I'm looking to be Merfolk. So, but once you're Merfolk, there's not a lot of wiggle room. So I was pretty nervous about taking this first and very willing to move off of it. But I do think that's the pick, and that's what I took there.
Yeah, I like it.
Moving on to pack two, we see the following cards. Tilinale's Knight, 1 and a red for a 2/2 human knight. When it attacks, if you control a dinosaur, it gets +1/+1 until end of turn. Queen's Commission, 2 and a white for the sorcery that says create 2/1/1 vampire creature tokens with lifelink. 1 with the wind, 1 and a blue for the enchantment aura that says enchanted creature gets +2/+2 and has flying. Colossal Dreadmaw, although not really interested in taking a 6-drop this early. 4 green-green for the 6/6 trample dinosaur. Seeker Squire, 1 and a black for the 1/2 human scout. When it enters the battlefield, it explores. Lightning Rig Crew, 2 and a red for the 0/5 goblin pirate. Has the ability tap, deal 1 damage to each opponent, and whenever you cast a pirate spell, untap it. And Deadeye Plunders, 3 blue-black for the 3/3 human pirate that gets +1/+1 for each treasure you control. No, each artifact you control, excuse me. And 2 blue-black activated ability to create a colorless treasure token.
This pack is much better than our first pack. I think there's many more strong cards here. But even without our Deeproot Warrior, so there's not really another green card that is that exciting to me here. But there are some other really strong first picks. I think it comes down to Seeker Squire and 1 with the wind here. Again, another really strong 2-drop that can either replace itself by drawing a land or be a 2-mana 2/3 that lets you scry the top card of your library is something I value a lot. But 1 with the wind is one of the most powerful things to do in this format. As we'll get into again in this episode, we really are valuing the powerful effects that enhance your creatures, like 1 with the Wind, Pirate's Cutlass, and Mark of the Vampire. So I'd be pretty excited to grab 1 with the Wind here. And of note, that 1 with the Wind goes really well in a Merfolk deck. So if you do end up going blue-green Merfolk with your Deeproot Warrior, the 1 with the Wind is going to slot in really nicely there.
But I think it's also nice, too, that it doesn't have to go in Merfolk. Like, it leaves you out to just be any other color, too. So it leaves you very flexible here. Like, it's not like you're taking a card that says Merfolk on it that makes you feel like you're locked into Merfolk. Any thought to Lightning Rig Crew? I know you were very high on that card at the start of the format. Has that gone down for you at all?
I feel like you're just calling me out here. You're just throwing me under the bus. Yeah, you know, Lightning Rig Crew is is perhaps not the riddle form of the format that I wanted it to be. I still think it's a very strong card, and if I am in a red-based pirate deck, I'm going to be excited about it. But it's not something that I would want to grab and really, like, go all in on pirates. It's more something that, like, if I see it, it's a signal to me that Pirates is open if I see it 4th, 5th, 6th pick. But it's not something that I want to grab in pick 2. I want to take something that is just going to be good in any deck I draft, and 1 with the Wind fits that bill.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I was asking because I think I've actually got Lightning Rig Crew over Seeker Squire for the moment. But that could be...
Oh, I do not. I do not have that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to pick 3. So we've got a Deeproot Warrior in our pile and a 1 with the Wind. Pick 3, you see the following cards. Raptor Companion, 1 and a white for a 3/1 dinosaur. Prosperous Pirates, 4 and a blue for a 3/4 human pirate that makes 2 treasure tokens when it enters the battlefield. Blossom Dryad probably is the best green card. 2 and a green for the 2/2 dryad, taps to untap target land. Stormfleet Spy, 2 and a blue for the 2/2 human pirate that raids when it enters the battlefield. If you attacked with a creature this turn, draw a card. And Rigging Runner, single red for the 1/1 first strike goblin pirate that's got raid trigger of entering the battlefield with a +1/+1 counter on it.
This is a pretty weak pack overall. So there's nothing that, like, on raw power level sticks out to me as being the best. So then I'm going to look at things that pair well with our first two picks. And I think that leads me to take Stormfleet Spy as the best blue card here to pair with 1 with the Wind over one of the green cards. Like you said, Blossom Dryad was the best card in the pack. So Blossom Dryad plus Deeproot Warrior is not really where I want to be. So I think I would come down on Stormfleet Spy here.
Yeah, that's also where I ended up. Not a super tough pick there after picking up 1 with the Wind.
Yeah.
But I think it's a nice follow-up. Leaves you directions. I think you would probably play that in a Merfolk deck, though. If you had a really good Merfolk deck, I think you'd be hoping not to play Stormfleet Spy, maybe.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's like just fine. Like a 3-mana 2/2 that replaces itself is actually pretty strong in this format, but I think there are better things you can do.
All right, moving on to pick 4 here. So we've got 2 blue cards and a green card in our pile. Now we see Thrash of Raptors, 3 and a red for the 3/3 dinosaur. As long as you control another dinosaur, it gets +2/+0 and trample. The card is a house in the dinosaur's deck.
Yeah.
Fathom Fleet Firebrand, 1 and a red for the 2/2 human pirate. It's got smoke breathing, patent pending, 1 and a red to give it +1/+0 until end of turn. New Horizons as the strongest green card in the pack. That's 2 and a green for the enchant land Aura. When it enters the battlefield, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. And enchanted land has tap to add 2 mana of any one color to your mana pool. Shipwreck Looter as the best blue card in the pack. 1 and a blue for a 2/1 human pirate. It's got raid trigger. When it enters the battlefield, you get a loot. Draw a card, discard a card. And Seeker Squire as a black card in the pack. It's the second Seeker Squire we've seen. That's 1 and a black for the 1/2 explore.
Yeah, so of note, you really haven't seen any good green since you took the Deeproot Warrior.
No, none at all.
And I think there's an argument for taking Shipwreck Looter here, just as a to stick with blue and see what else you want to figure out. But I think Seeker Squire and Fathom Fleet Firebrand are enough better 2-drops that moving off of blue to take a hedge on either a black or a red card here is pretty strong. And between those two, I definitely think Fathom Fleet Firebrand is great. I mean, this is one of, I think, the best commons in the format, which is a far cry from where we came out of in the set review. Not that we were down on this card, but just that we weren't really that excited about it either. Just thought it was a 2/2 with upside. But it's a 2/2 with upside is really good in this aggressive format. So I think Fathom Fleet Firebrand is a really good hedge pick here and might be a signal that red is open.
Yeah, that's what I went with. I took the Fathom Fleet Firebrand. So now we've got a green card, a Deeproot Warrior, 2 blue cards, a 1 with the Wind, a Stormfleet Spy, and a red card in Fathom Fleet Firebrand. So we've got lots of options. And this is how I like to start Ixalan drafts. I want to have options to go into multiple archetypes, or I just want my archetype to be obviously wide open, which is not the case here, I don't think. Like, Merfolk doesn't seem to be super open in this seat.
No.
Where we started. So moving on to pick 5 here, we see several options. Shaper Apprentice, that's 1 and a blue for the 2/1 Merfolk Wizard. It's got flying as long as you control another Merfolk. Best blue card in the pack. Pirate's Cutlass, which a lot of people have pegged as the best common, and I think you and I do too. It's 3 mana for the equipment. When it enters the battlefield, attach it to target pirate you control. Equipped creature gets +2/+1, and it's got an equip cost of 2. No real red cards to speak of in the pack. There's a Fire Shrine Keeper, that's the single red for the 1/1 Menace, that's got the 8 mana tap to deal 3 damage up each of up to 2 target creatures. There's an Ixalan's Keeper as the best green card in the pack. 1 and a green for the 2/2 human shaman with the activated ability of 8, tap it, sack it, and target creature gets +5/+5 and gains trample until end of turn. And then there's also a Deadeye Quartermaster in the pack, 3 and a blue for the 2/2 human pirate, and when it enters the battlefield, you can search up a equipment or a vehicle card.
You had me at Pirate's Cutlass, Ben.
Yep, could have stopped there.
Yeah, hard to believe that there would be much better than that, and hard to believe that the people to our right should have taken the cards that they took over it instead, you know?
Yeah, because there's already a couple commons missing from this pack.
Right, yeah. So I definitely think Pirate's Cutlass is the pick here. It's nice that you've already got a few pirates with the Fathom Fleet Firebrand and the Stormfleet Spy, but even without the auto equip, the Pirate's Cutlass is very strong in this format.
Yeah. All right, moving on to pick 6. So we've got the 2 blue cards, 1 green card, 1 red card, and a Pirate's Cutlass. Very flexible here. Pick 6, we see another Shaper Apprentice. So maybe Merfolk is open. That's the second Shaper Apprentice we've seen in a row here. We see another Fathom Fleet Firebrand. And we see Wild Growth Walker as the best green card in the back. Although we're a far cry from that, we have no explore so far. 1 and a green for the 1/3 elemental that whenever a creature you control explores, you put a +1/+1 counter on it and you gain 3 life.
Yeah, pretty nice to see Fathom Fleet Firebrand here pick 6. I think that makes me excited about having the Cutlass even more and makes me excited about having picked up Fathom Fleet Firebrand a couple picks ago.
Yeah, that's also what I went with. And then the rest of this draft kind of rounded out. Interestingly, I thought maybe there were some Merfolk signals. Pick 7, I picked up a Shaper Apprentice. Pick 8, I picked up a Cumenas Speaker. There was also a River Herald's Boon in that pack with the Shaper Apprentice, but I took the Shaper Apprentice over the River Herald's Boon because I knew I was blue. I just didn't know if I was blue, red, or blue, green, so I was certain to play the Shaper Apprentice in either deck. And then I actually ended up settling on blue, red. Blue and red were the most open throughout the course of the draft, so I had options to go into Merfolk or blue, red, and blue, red ended up being what was open in my seat.
Yeah, I mean, looked like the deck that you ended up drafting was pretty great. And the fact that you were able to move so freely off of the Deeproot Warrior, I think probably allowed you to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so we're going to move into our main topic today. The whole episode we're going to be devoted to how to draft and win in Ixalan. And I think the most important thing to discuss here is sort of a paradigm shift that has happened with Ixalan, which is, I think, a reason a lot of people have been struggling with the format, and ourselves included, save for the last couple weeks. And that has to do with a fundamental idea for Limited of bread as the correct drafting order. So I feel like a lot of people learn, like, bread is a pretty big level up moment in your early Limited days.
Yeah, like, I remember when I was a kid at the card shop learning about breads, bombs, removal, evasion abilities, dudes. And I thought it was, like, the coolest thing since sliced bread, literally. Like, I was like, yes, this is awesome. Like, I immediately felt like I was better at Magic when somebody told me that.
Right, so it, like, just gave you a way to categorize cards into, like, five different slots and how to rank them and how to approach draft in that way. The problem is that Ixalan does not conform to that level of evaluations. So bombs certainly still exist. You want to be very conscious of when you open or when you get past game-winning bombs in this format, because they don't exist that much. I mean, there are a handful of really powerful spells in the format. Hostage Taker, Regisaur Alpha.
Vraska, Whatley.
Vraska, Whatley, sure. But there's also a lot of clunkers at the rare and mythic rare level. So you don't see those bombs that often. And we don't really have removal as the second thing. We're going to introduce a new acronym here. We're going to call this one BEARD.
Arr, those pirates have their beards.
Ooh, I like that. I like that a lot. So B, certainly still for bombs. But E, we're going to say, stands for enhancements. And that's mostly going to be Pirate's Cutlass and One with the Wind. Pirate's Cutlass, we already talked about as being what we think is probably the best common in the format. And that is for two reasons. One is that it's colorless, so it's going to leave you not committed to any archetype or color when you take it, which is pretty important in this format, because this format is a lot about finding your open lane and your open archetype or colors for your seat. And Pirate's Cutlass lets you wait one pick longer before you have to commit to any sort of color requirements. And the second is that the power level of the creatures is pretty flat. The format is based around 2/2s and 3/3s. I think Semulin mentioned this in the last week's episode. He said this is a format of hill giants. And you can sort of look at 2-drops, 3-drops, 4-drops, and 5-drops in the format, and they're all 2/2s and 3/3s. Now, sometimes they get to explore, and your 2/2 becomes a 3/3, or your 3/3 becomes a 4/4, like Sunrise Seeker. But let's take a look at in red. You've got Fathomfleet Firebrand, right? Let's look at black. So you've got Direfleet Hoarder. That's one and a black for a 2/1. Then you've got Deadeye Tormentor. That's two and a black for a 2/2. Then you've got Direfleet Interloper. That's three and a black for a 2/2 with Explore, so it could be a 3/3. So all of these things you're investing one mana more in for the same amount of power and toughness. So 2/2s and 3/3s rule the format. So when you get to slap a Pirate's Cutlass on something and make that a 4/3 or a 5/4 if you're putting it on a 3/3. That makes it much larger than the rest of the creatures that are going to be on the battlefield, save for a few dinos. So it's really going to outclass most of the creatures on the board, which is why Pirate's Cutlass is so strong. And similarly to why One with the Wind is so strong, it buffs up the power and toughness and also tacks on evasion. So we're going to go bombs, enhancements, aggro next, over removal. So we are valuing efficient, aggressive 2-drops and 3-drops over the clunky removal spells of the format. Now, sometimes you're going to have a Walk the Plank or Vanquish the Weak or a Pious Interdiction that you need. I mean, I think I really hope I have one strong removal spell in my deck, but you don't need much more. This format is really based around creature combat, so things like combat tricks go up in value a lot, like Vampire Zeal. Skullduggery is basically a removal spell and can be a 2-for-1. Sure Strike goes up in value, and I think you and I probably have Sure Strike ahead of Unfriendly Fire at this moment.
Yeah, I think I like Sure Strike better than Unfriendly Fire.
Yeah, so things like Unfriendly Fire and Contract Killing, these like 5-mana removal spells, don't actually net you a lot of mana. They're like negative tempo plays for your deck because the format is based around these really powerful 2-drops. Like, when your opponent has their Fathomfleet Firebrand beating you down and your answer is to wait till turn 5 to play Contract Killing on it, that feels bad on so many levels.
Well, and heaven forbid your opponent has a Dive Down also. Like, when you get your Contract Killing Dive Downed, it just feels so miserable.
Especially if you were hoping to use those 2 treasures that turn to do something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then D for dudes, like, you just want to then continue to round out your deck with as many, like, good 2-drops, 3-drops that you can, some even 1-drops that you can to make your deck good. Now, and this is not to say that control decks or mid-range decks are not viable in the format, because they certainly are, but you just have to keep, even with that mindset, you have to keep this order in mind of how you're ranking cards, because this is how other winning players are going to be ranking cards. They're going to be valuing 2-drops. They're going to be curving out on you. When you are on the draw and your opponent plays something on turn 2 and you don't, you're not winning that game most of the time.
Yeah, that's really tough when you're on the draw and you miss your 2-drop. And I think if you're a control deck, you need to have a plan for your opponent going 1-drop, suiting it up with one with the wind or swashbuckling. Those are very, very common plays that happen in this format, and you have to have a plan to deal with them.
Great. All right, do you want to talk about sort of the mechanics of navigating a draft in this format?
Yeah, I think you like gave an initial outline on this like very well on Men From Moto last week, but I just want to reiterate it in case any of our regular listeners didn't go check you out over on Men From Moto. So here's how I think both of us sit down and try to navigate a draft, much more so than ever before. Like, I'm really trying to pay attention to, and maybe that just means I wasn't being a great drafter in other formats, but I think what wheels in pack one is super important in this set, because it gives you clues as to what tribes might be open for your seat. And we've already been over this several times, but having enough 2-drops in whatever like color pair you decide to be in is critical. You cannot end up with only 3 or 4 2-drops and expect your deck to be very good in this format.
I was thinking today that 5 is the minimum that I want.
That seems like a good number to me, yeah.
If I have less than 5, I'm worried about my deck.
I think maybe the one deck that can get away with less than that is Vampires, because they have the life gain to make up for missing their 2-drop. But even then, I'm not thrilled to be missing my 2-drop. I want to be playing a Bishop Soldier on turn 2 if I'm Vampires.
Exactly.
And I think another like big overarching thought for this format that actually Ehe Dude, and quick shout out to Ehe Dude, he made the top 8, his name's Sasha, his first name's Sasha, he made the top 8 of a PTQ on Modo today and lost in the semifinals of the draft, which I'm sure was a bummer for him, but like huge congratulations. He had no rares in his sealed deck, it was all commons and uncommons, he went 8-1 in sealed, drafted a very good red-white aggro deck, and then lost in the semis. And I'm sure if he keeps at it, he's going to be getting in there, because he's a very good player, very good drafter.
Yeah, I think this is also a great time to shout out to him and to Ryan Sachs, who I think helped us really figure out how to change our evaluations of the cards in this format and really helped us turn around our like slumps into winning streaks.
Yes, everything we're outlining this episode, like they've talked to us about, and I think like we've found it to be true through drafting and listening to them and things like that.
Right.
So we definitely experienced this too, but certainly the initial ideas for this were from them. Ryan Sachs writes for Star City Games. He's a great guy. Had him Skype in on stream this week. It was super fun. Yeah, so one thing that Ehe Dude typed in my chat today while he was like just crushing the mocks was like he was hanging out in my stream while he was playing the mocks. He said it relaxed him. He said you want to be the ones asking questions in this format and making your opponent have the answers rather than have your deck based around being the one that's having answers to the questions that your opponent's asking. And I thought that was a very like simplistic way to put it. You're trying to ask questions. You want to be very proactive in the format. And the other thing when I'm drafting that I want to try to do is give myself outs to end up in as many good archetypes as possible, or just have my archetype obviously wide open from the get-go, but that's not going to happen very often. So just kind of a general thing, I think you outlined this pretty well on Men From Moto, is picks 1 through 3, you're trying to take the best card or the most flexible card out of every pack, or when that's not really an option, like an all-star in its archetype. Like on stream today, I had to first pick Shapers of Nature, the 1 blue-green for the 3/3 Merfolk Shaman, which like I'm not thrilled to first pick that because it only goes in one deck, right? Like if you're not playing blue-green, like that card's not making your deck, but it's very good in that deck. So I think that's also like something you can do in picks 1 through 3 that's fine.
Yeah.
And then picks 4 through 8, you're trying to pay very close attention to signal cards for each of the best archetypes. And we're going to outline those later in the episode, like what cards are clues for which archetype being open. So trying to see which of these cards you're seeing in picks 4 through 8. And then picks 9 through 15, you're supposed to take very careful note of like what cards are wheeling. Like, do they say vampire on them? Do they say dinosaur on them? Are you wheeling 2-drop merfolk? And heaven forbid you wheel one of the best cards in an archetype, then you're probably just supposed to move in,
right?
No matter what's going on. And then like kind of going into pack 2, like you either want to position yourself to be solidly in an archetype, like know your vampires or know your merfolk or know your pirates, or have outs to be like 2 to 3 good archetypes. And I think a lot of that comes from like 1 with the wind, like aggressive strategies. Like a lot of times if you're base blue, you have outs. Blue pairs very well with all of the colors. You can have outs to be like blue red or blue green, similarly. So we're going to go over all these archetype cards. And before we do that, we're going to take a look at what we think are the top commons in the set and why. So you want to run us through that, Ethan?
Yeah, I do. I just want to piggyback on one of the ideas you just said, as the, like, trying to figure out what the open archetype for your seed is. I think in this format, more than others, it's really important to not be gun-shy. I feel like there are times in previous formats that maybe aren't so like aggressively bent or like tribally bent that I might be like, well, I'll just like take this red card over this green card because it pairs well with the red cards I already have, so I don't have to make a decision of what my second color is. But if that green card happens to be like an all-star in like River Herald's Boon, that's an all-star in Merfolk, that is something you really want to jump on and be like, maybe this is a Merfolk signal, maybe it isn't. But if it is, I'm going to get rewarded handsomely. And if it's not, I'm not missing out on a ton. So I think you really need to be able to like jump on that when you see it, rather than being like, okay, well, I see that River Herald's Boon, but I'll wait and see what happens in the next pack. Because that can sort of be disastrous, because it can put the person to your left into the deck that you're supposed to be in.
Right. In this format, I find myself almost wanting early in the draft to be in multiple colors so that I'm flexible and I have options to go many different directions. I really don't mind my first four picks being cards of different colors, because then I've got lots of color combinations to mash up to find the right open tribe.
You saw that thing I posted on Twitter that was my first six picks.
Yeah, I did.
A Pirate's Cutlass and then a common from each color.
But I think that's a great place to be in this format.
It wasn't bad. I mean, my deck ended up as a 2-1. Like, it wasn't great, but I did feel like I was taking the best cards out of each pack and sort of making hedge picks on, like, well, maybe Vampires is open, maybe Dinosaurs is open, that sort of thing. All right, anyway, so to talk about not train wrecking here, because I think train wrecking is a phrase that's been thrown around a lot for this format in particular, and I think that's because people maybe commit too early or aren't able to get off with a are on to commit to the archetype they're supposed to be in. So the most powerful cards that you can take at the start, other than certainly bombs or really strong cards and archetypes, are cards that keep you open, cards that you keep talking about, these cards that are going to be powerful in any deck regardless of what the archetype or tribe is. So that's why Pirate's Cutlass is at the top of this list for us. It's just going to go into any deck, no matter what it is, if it has pirates or not. Like, all the creatures are going to be small, and you're going to want to suit them up with a Pirate's Cutlass. Similarly, we've got One with the Wind on there as a card that's going to go in any deck you play that has blue cards in it, whether it's super aggro, whether it's mid-range, even whether it's controlling. Like, One with the Wind is going to be a very powerful effect in this format. Strong two-drops like Bishop Soldier and Fathom Fleet Firebrand are going to slot in here. Strong tempo-based creatures like Water Trap Weaver and Territorial Hammerskull are going to go in any deck you play. And cheap removal in black like Vanquish the Weak and Skullduggery, note that Contract Killing is not on this list, are all going to go into any deck that has black in it, as long as you've got the Vanquish and the Skullduggery in your pile. And I think one thing to note here is that there are no green cards on this list, right? We've got literally no green cards. We've got red, we've got white, we've got blue, we've got black, we've even got an artifact, but no green cards. Ben, talk to us about why there are no green cards on this list.
Yeah, I think trying to avoid green early is really good because it's not very flexible. Like what you said, you're trying to avoid train wrecking. I think one of the biggest ways to train wreck in this format is if your first pick cards are cards that only go into Merfolk, like green cards that only go into Merfolk, and then Merfolk isn't open in your seat. And you either try to force it and don't end up with a good Merfolk deck, because I think a medium Merfolk deck is just a bad deck, because it's really hard to like outpace life gain from vampires or things like that if you're not really like the super all-in aggro Merfolk deck.
Right, I mean, like, a medium Merfolk deck probably means you drafted wrong. A medium Merfolk deck probably means something else was what you were supposed to be drafting.
Yes, yes. And I think, like, the other green cards, like, I'm not really happy with any of the green archetypes. Like, green-white, I've literally never drafted green-white in the format.
Nope.
And every time I play against green-white, I win. Like, that's why I haven't drafted it, because it just seems so clunky to me on the other side of the table, and I'm always able to beat whatever it is they're doing, either tempo it out or race it with one of the wind, with wind or some of those things. So I've literally never drafted green-white, and Ryan today said he's got like a 90% win rate against green-white or something. Like, he tracks what he plays against in stream today. So really trying to avoid green-white. Also, like, not in love with green-black. I think it's a viable deck if it comes together. Like, if green, exactly green and black are open in your seat, it's a thing you can do. But I'm not looking to do that at all. Like, I'll do that if I get pigeonholed into it, and I think it's fine. And red green dinos, I've been having some success with lately, mostly if I've got Savage Stomp. That card's been a huge house for me.
Yeah.
In green red dinos. And I think also to be green red dinos, for your deck to be good, you really need Otapec Huntmaster and or Drover the Mighty. And all three of those cards are uncommons. I think a lot of the good green decks outside of Merfolk really rely on uncommons and rares to make your deck be good. So starting a draft there is a rough place to be if you're banking on uncommons and rares getting past you, because it just might not happen. Whereas all these other decks that we're having a lot of success with are more common and uncommon based.
Yeah.
So if you're starting green and Merfolk and Dinos aren't open in your seat, you either like train wreck or you give up a lot of your first like 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 picks to move into another archetype, which can just be a disaster because sometimes it's hard to make playables in this format if you don't realize what you're supposed to be doing soon enough. So I just kind of have some cards here that I'm willing to start in green, and outside of these cards, I'm not willing to go into green. Drover the Mighty, that's the one in a green for the 1/1 human druid that taps to add any color of mana to your mana pool and turns into a 3/3 if you control a dinosaur. Savage Stomp, that's 2 in a green for the sorcery that puts a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control, and that creature fights another target creature. And it costs a single green if it's targeting a dinosaur, which is huge. That's a way for the dinosaur deck to come back from behind against some of these more aggressive starts. Waker of the Wilds, that's 2 green green for the 3/3 merfolk something, shaman maybe. You can pay green green X to put +1/+1 counters on a land and turn it into a 0/0 creature with haste. Ripjaw Raptor, that's the 2 green green for the 4/5 dinosaur that's got an enrage trigger of draw a card. And Carnage Tyrant, that's 4 green green for a 7/6 hexproof trample, I think that's it, dinosaur.
Can't be countered.
Can't be countered, that's right. Mythic rare. Or I'll start with a Merfolk, like we saw in that draft that we did for our roundtable today. A Merfolk, we picked the Deeproot Warrior out of a very weak pack. And if that's the case, I'm very, very willing to move off that Merfolk card.
Yeah.
So that's the list for me. Do you have any others?
No, I think that's a great list. I mean, I've really been taking the, like, avoid green to heart. I haven't gotten a red-green dinos deck, and that's probably my fault. I may have been missing out on green decks, but I've just had a lot of success starting in some form of Esper colors and then moving from there if red happens to be open, but we're really only going into green for the Merfolk deck. And how I feel like you can get into the Merfolk deck is paying attention to what comes picks 4 through 7, 4 through 8-ish, and sometimes pick 3. So it's really hard to figure out what signals you're getting in like picks 2 and even pick 3, because like someone might have taken a foil, someone might have taken an uncommon or whatever. Like, it's hard to know what signals are open. But by pick 4, I'm willing to think that Merfolk is open, specifically for 3 cards here, and that's going to be Vine Shaper Mystic, Shapers of Nature, and River Herald's Boon. And so Vine Shaper Mystic is the 2 and a green for the 1/3 Merfolk, that when it comes into play, you can put a +1/+1 counter onto each of up to 2 target Merfolk. So it can either buff itself, or ideally you can go 1-drop, 2-drop Vine Shaper Mystic, make each of the 1 and 2 drops that you played bigger, and then attack with them, which is a really powerful thing to do. Shapers of Nature, we talked about, that's the 1 green blue for the 3/3 Merfolk that gets to either have an activated ability of 3 and a green to put a counter on something, or 2 and a blue to remove a counter to draw a card. And River Herald's Boon is a premium common here, a really strong Merfolk signal. That's the 1 and a green for the instant to put a +1/+1 counter on a creature you control, and then a +1/+1 counter on a Merfolk you control. So the versatility of this card really makes combat kind of miserable for your opponents. You can save 1 Merfolk by putting 2+1 counters on it, and then it's a much bigger creature for the rest of the game, or you can sort of spread those out and put them on multiple creatures. But all 3 of those cards are really strong cards that I'm willing to move in to Merfolk on around picks 4. Picks 5 and 6, I know this is, we're sort of like getting nitty gritty of like, when am I seeing these cards? But I sort of have a notch below those cards, Kamina Speaker and River Sneak. So Kamina Speaker is the 1 drop, the green mana for the 1/1 that gets +1/+1 if you either have an island or another Merfolk in play. And River Sneak is the 1 and a blue for the 1/1 unblockable that gets +1/+1 until end of turn when you cast a Merfolk. So both of these cards I think are really strong in Merfolk, certainly, but are cards that you are going to want to maybe pick up a little later than the 3 we mentioned before. And then the last thing I think you want to be aware of is what's going later in the pack. What's going 7th, 8th? What's coming back from your first pack, your second pack, my 9th or 10th pick? Are you seeing late Shaper Apprentices? Are you seeing late Deeproot Warriors? Are you seeing late Jade Guardians? Like, the Shaper Apprentice is the one in a blue for the 2-1 that gets flying if you have a Merfolk. Deeproot Warrior we talked about in the roundtable, that's the one in a green 2-2. Jade Guardian is 3 and a green for the 2-2 Hexproof that comes into play and puts a counter on, +1 counter on a Merfolk you control. All of these cards are things that I am aware of in packs and aware of them at different stages of my first pack and give me ideas about how many other Merfolk drafters are at the table.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a very good list. I've got Kumena's Speaker a little bit higher than you. I think that card's pretty important. Getting a one drop down that's a 2-2 on turn one in this format is pretty big game. So I've got that maybe on the same tier with those other three cards, Vineshaper Mystic, Shapers of Nature, and River Herald's Boon.
The only reason I don't think that you need it that much is the existence of Jungle Delver. I agree that you need a one drop, and it's nice when that one drop is a 2-2. But when you've got the River Herald's Boons or the Vineshaper Mystics, like, just having Jungle Delver on turn one is gonna do that job basically as well.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. All right, so some Vampires signal cards here. I think we've got Vampires as one of the best decks in the format.
Yeah.
Some signal cards. A big one for me was when I understood that Anointed Deacon was like the card that makes Vampires tick, along with Pirate's Cutlass. Pirate's Cutlass is very good. So Anointed Deacon in Vampires is the 4 and a black for the 3/3. And at the beginning of combat, it triggers and you can give target vampire on your team +2/+0 until end of turn. Pirate's Cutlass, we've talked about, it's the equipment that gives a creature +2/+1. Dustborn Sky Marcher is another one. That's the single white for the 1/1 flyer that has the activated ability 1 white, tap, give target attacking vampire +1/+1 until end of turn.
Can I pause you for a second?
Sure, absolutely.
So can you talk about why Anointed Deacon and Pirate's Cutlass are so important in the vampire deck?
Yeah, because Vampires kind of wants to build up an army of 1/1 lifelinkers or bishop soldiers, cards with lifelink, and then ways to buff them and kind of grind the opponent into oblivion with their 1/1 lifelink tokens. So ideally, you've got like a Pirate's Cutlass and an Anointed Deacon or 2 Anointed Deacons on your side of the battlefield, and you're suiting up one of those 1/1 lifelink tokens with the Pirate's Cutlass and the buff from Anointed Deacon and swinging in with maybe like a 5/2 lifelink token or a 5/1 lifelink token if you've got 2 Anointed Deacons. And yeah, that's really hard, one, for opponents to race. Like, they can't just ignore it and let it hit them for 5 and then you gain 5. Nigh impossible to race, but then also they're trading cards for it. Your tokens, your cards that generate 2 tokens, like your Queen's Commission or the uncommon, the 2 white and black that makes 3. What's the name of that card?
Call to the Feast. Dinner's
Call
ready, baby.
Feast. Boom. Yeah.
also Paladin of the Bloodstained.
Then the Vampires deck just grinds the opponent into oblivion and uses those tokens as card advantage. Like, each of those tokens essentially becomes a very good card worth of value. A 5/1 lifelink is a good card.
Yeah, it is.
It's a great card, especially when you're getting 2 of them off of 1 card.
But remember what we talked about at the start of the episode with Beard. Like, this is a format of 2/2s and 3/3s, and when you are turning a card like Call to the Feast, which makes 3 1/1 lifelinkers, when you're turning each of those into 3/1 lifelinkers that trade with literally 90% of the creatures in the format, you're turning your Call to the Feast into 3 relevant bodies. So it just makes combat miserable, it makes racing impossible, and it really makes Call to the Feast a literal 3-for-1.
Yeah, it really is great. I had the Nuts Vampire deck at the end of my stream today. Mm-hmm. Also, I had an insane stream today. I had like over 200 people watching me for like most of the day. It was awesome.
What?
That's the first time I've ever had that happen to me.
I mean, I'm not surprised. You're great, but you are crushing it this week. I feel like every time I've looked in, you're like cruising at 100 natural viewers, like no host needed.
Yeah, I didn't have any hosts either. Like, it was out natural. And like, Gabriel Nassif was streaming too. Like, like, how do I have more viewers than him? That's so insane to me.
You're the Lord of Limited, baby.
I know, yeah. Streaming's great. Like, I had never dreamed that streaming would be this awesome. I knew I would like it, but I'd never fathomed that it would go this well. Anyway, quick aside there.
Yeah, I love it.
What I was going to say was that I had 4 Anointed Deacons in that deck. And I had an option to pick up a 5th, and I was like, 5 seems like too many. Wrong. I would have played 6. I had a Bishop of Rebirth. Yeah, it was so good. All I wanted every game was like, can I just draw an Anointed Deacon, please? Like,
wow.
And when you have 2, it's great. Like, I think 5, 6 might be the max, but I think I would play up to 6 as my only 5 drops. I just always wanted that card. It was so good. All right, so Dustborn Skymarcher, the single white for the 1/1 flyer that pays a single mana to a white mana to tap and give target attacking creature +1/+1. That's another signal card. Odonto Vanguard is great. Just good in any white deck, but excels in vampires. That's 1 and a white for the 1/1 vampire that gets +2/+0 when it attacks, and you can pay 4 life to give it indestructible. It's just impossible to block profitably. Call to the Feast. Oh, it's right there. Duh. on the notes, 2 white-black for the uncommon sorcery that makes 3/1/1 vampire tokens with lifelink, and then wheeling cards with a creature type vampire on them. Pack one, like a Skymarch Bloodletter would be awesome, but even the 1/3 flyer for 1 and a white, Skymarch something?
That's Sky Legion Sovereign type. Something?
I don't know. We're terrible with cards.
Name that card!
Yeah, but pretty much anything, a Legion Conquistador that's 2 and a white for the 2/2 that goes and searches up other Legion Conquistadors, the Squadron Hawk, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much anything that says Vampire on it. If you're wheeling cards, because I think people are competing for that deck a lot, so I think it can support 2 drafters.
Yes, I agree.
So if you're wheeling cards that say Vampire on them, that probably means there's only one other person doing it, so it's probably safe for you to move in. But it's worth noting that your Vampire's deck will not be good at all if you don't have Anointed Deacon or Pirate's Cutlass. It's essential that you've got ways to make your 1/1 lifelink tokens relevant. So the biggest signal, I think, for vampires is Anointed Deacon. If you see that, pick 4. Or even earlier, I think it's fine to take a flyer on it, because it's very splashable in a blue-white deck, too, or like a white-based deck with a lot of vampires.
I want to add 2 cards to this list.
Yeah, do it.
That's all right. One is Paladin of the Bloodstained. I think I'm considering Paladin. I mean, Paladin of the Bloodstained is just a good card, period, but especially in vampires, if I'm seeing that 5th, 6th, that makes me think that vampires might be open, or at least there might be only one other vampires drafter. Like, that's not a, I guess I should say, that's not a card that I'm like, if I'm doing something else in my first 5 picks and then I see Paladin, I'm not like, oh no, I have to be the vampire drafter and take it. But right. If I've got maybe some white cards or some, let's say I've got like maybe some black cards and some blue cards, if I see Paladin and no blue cards, I might be like, ooh, maybe I'm supposed to ditch blue and be black-white.
Right.
That's the kind of thing. And the other card is Bishop of the Bloodstained. And now the 5-drop slot is very contested in vampires, specifically because of Anointed Deacon being so strong, and then Contract Killing existing and being a removal spell that you're not embarrassed to have one of in your deck. And then also Glorifier of Dusk existing, and I think people thinking it's very good. So Glorifier of Dusk is the 3 white-white, I think we can call it Seraph Angel, the 4/4 vampire that you can pay 2 life to give it flying or pay 2 life to give it vigilance. But I have that lower than Bishop of the Bloodstained, and the Bishop is not something I'm like super excited about. But if I do see it 4th, 5th, it does make me think that Vampires is open. So I would consider, depending on how my draft went, grabbing that there and moving in and thinking that maybe Vampires was what I was supposed to be drafting.
Interesting. Like, I'm just kind of off Bishop of the Bloodstained in my Vampires decks, so that's why I didn't have it on the list. I just don't think it's very good. Like, Anointed Deacon is just so much better.
It's so much better, but I think, it's weird, but I think Bishop of the Bloodstained represents something.
Yes.
Rather than being a valuable card in your deck necessarily, but I think it represents vampires as an open archetype.
That's fair enough. And I think if you let it slide by, other people might certainly take it as a signal and move into vamps.
Exactly. So I think you passing it means you're passing the signal, and you receiving the signal means like you have the chance to move in on it.
Yep, fair enough. All right. What about pirates?
Okay, so Pirates is a little less clean because Pirate's Cutlass is basically the only quote-unquote payoff for Pirates outside of some rare cards, and Pirate's Cutlass is just so strong anyway that it's going to be picked up by a competent drafter such as yourself listening to this podcast. But some things you're looking out for are cards that can wheel that are pretty strong in pirate cards, specifically Headstrong Brute. That's the 3/3 that can't block but can gain menace if you have another pirate in red. Siren's Ruse, which is the 1 and a blue instant that blinks a creature, and if it's a pirate, you draw a card. So this card is like, you know, kind of strong if you have some Enter the Battlefield effects, but very strong in a pirate's deck because it sort of lets you, you know, rebuy some raid triggers and draw a card, or save your creature from removal and draw a card. It's a pretty versatile trick that I've liked a lot, especially in a pretty dedicated Pirates deck.
I've never cast that card, but it keeps wrecking me.
Oh, it's really good.
I keep thinking I need to be taking it higher because it keeps crushing me, but I've literally never had it in a Pirates deck because I always want to pick it up on the wheel, and I never really seem to wheel them.
That does seem right to me, to where you want to pick them, unless you, like, I think you could, if you're set up in a few packs, the first 2 packs, that you could then take it early in pack 3, but I think like 7th, 8th wheeling is about where you want to be taking that card.
And I think the other reason I don't end with them because my Pirates decks are aggressive a lot and enchantment based, and so I value Dive Down higher. So I'm always taking Dive Down over it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Siren's Ruse is more belongs in a more grindy blue-black version of the deck where you're, like, rebuying your Deadeye Tormentors or your Stormfleet Spies to draw cards or, you know, your Hostage Takers if you're a sicko. And then March of the Drowned, I think, is a really, really good card. I mean, just the ability to pay one mana to get back your best two creatures in your graveyard, especially in this format where trading off your two power creatures for your opponent's two power creatures is something that really happens a lot. And then just being able to go, two for one, and I get to replay one of them is a huge tempo swing in your favor. Lightning Rig Crew is something we talked about before. That's the 05 in red for Tuna Red that you can ping your opponent and then it tap it, and then you can untap it to when you cast a pirate spell. Lightning Rig Crew, I think, is really good and really good in multiples, but it's tough. It sort of feels like it competes a little bit with the identity of red and the 3-drop slot in general, just because, like, Headstrong Brute is also a good 3-drop in red pirate-based decks, but is trying to do something different than Lightning Rig Crew is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Cutlass we talked about, and then the rares that really make you want to move into pirates or make you want to prioritize pirates are, I think, Fel Flagship at the top of the list. Like, this is a card I'm thrilled to first pick, thrilled to pick up if it's passed to me. This is the 3-mana vehicle that's a 3/3 with crew 3, and when it deals damage to your opponent, they discard a card, and it gives all of your pirates +1/+0, so it allows you to, like, crew it with a 2-powered pirate, because now that 2-powered pirate is a 3-powered pirate, and so on. Fathom Fleet Captain, this is the 1 and a black for the 2/1 menace that when it attacks, if you control another non-pirate or non-token pirate, you can pay 2 to make a 2/2 menace token, which is insane. And then Dreamcaller Siren is the 2 blue-blue for the 3/3 with flash, flying, can only block creatures with flying, and if you control another pirate when it enters the battlefield, you get to tap 2 non-land permanents that your opponent controls. I mean, all those cards are just, like, really, really strong and really big benefits for having a critical mass of pirates in your deck.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to dinos here. I've been having some success with red-green dinosaurs lately. So some of the signal cards for dinosaurs, I think the headliners are Otopec Huntmaster, Drover the Mighty, Savage Stomp. Those three kind of are in a tier of their own and are cards that I'm willing to take early, like picks 1 through 3. And certainly if I see one, pick 4, like, is a huge signal to me that dinosaurs is open. Otopec Huntmaster is the 1 in the red for the 1/2 that makes your dinosaurs cost 1 less to cast and can tap to give a dinosaur haste. That card is super scary on the other side of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
I had 2 of those in a deck today that was just disgusting. Drover the Mighty, 1 and a green for a 1/1 human shaman that can tap to add a mana of any color to your mana pool and gets +2/+2 if you control another dinosaur. Just both of those cards being 2-drops that help you ramp out your dinos are very, very powerful. And then Savage Stomp is the removal spell that puts a +1/+1 counter and fights and costs a single green if you're targeting a dinosaur. So that's a huge way to make up tempo in the dinosaurs decks if you get a slow start. So I think those three are kind of in a tier of their own. Raging Swordtooth, also very good, but slightly a notch below those. That's the uncommon build around. 3 red, not really a build around, but the uncommon headliner for the red-green archetype. 3 red-green for the 5/5 dinosaur with trample. And when it enters the battlefield, it deals 1 damage to each other creature. So triggers your own enrage, crushes the vampire deck, kills all their 1/1 lifelink tokens. Pretty good against Merfolk as well.
I hate this card.
A Raging Swordtooth?
Yeah, like, why? It triggers your just because I had a deck with 2 of them and I played against someone who had a bunch of enrage triggers. Like,
that's not super common though.
It's miserable when that happens. I'm gonna tell you, that card's stupid.
No, like it. It's so good. That card's good. Whatever. You just had a bad experience.
Yeah, and I'm done. I'm done forever.
Thrash of Raptors at common, I think, is a very big payoff for dinosaurs. Yeah. Like, probably the best payoff at common. It's 3 and a red for the 3/3 dinosaur that gets +2/+0 and trample if you control another dinosaur. That hits hard.
Mm-hmm.
And especially backed up by combat tricks like Sure Strike or something is just very hard to deal with. And I think it's even a reason to play like bad clunky dinosaurs, like the 3/1 Raptor Companion in white, mm-hmm. or the 2/1 Haster, what is that card called? Nest Robber?
Nest Robber, yeah.
Yeah. And I think another signal for dinos is Wheeling Tillinale's Knights. I think I'm fine not like picking Tillinale's Knights like picks 4 through 7 also, if I, because it's just a fine red 2-drop, but especially if you're seeing them on the wheel, that's a signal to me that nobody else is valuing like dinosaur aggro, and it's a very strong card if you've got like 8 to 10 dinosaurs in your deck.
So here's where I struggle with red green dinosaurs.
Yeah,
I feel like I understand the red white aggressive deck, but red green dinosaurs is tough for me because I do feel like I want Otopec Huntmaster and Drover the Mighty, so I want to be ramping into some good top end. So then where do cards like Tilinalli's Knight fit into that?
I think you're just beating down. You're like red-green beat down. You curve out. You curve, like curving Tilinalli's Knight into like the 4-2, yeah, into Thrash of Raptors, into Savage Stomp, like your blocker that's left, and you're hitting for like 10 a turn. Your yeah. creatures hit so hard. Like if your opponent ever makes one misstep and you've got a timely Savage Stomp. Now, granted, like some of those creatures trade down, like the 4-2, you have to be careful about when to attack with it. And sometimes it doesn't always pan out that way. But I think you're like an aggressive beatdown. I don't think you're really ramping. Like, I think you want to have a critical mass of dinosaurs, specifically Thrash of Raptors. I think Thrash of Raptors is actually the key card for like red-green dinosaurs. And then I'll like have like a couple Colossal Dreadmaws at the top of my curve. But like, you don't really need to ramp to a six drop. Like, you're going to hit six mana some amount of the time in this format, even if you're not ramping to it. And then that's why Drover and Otapec Huntmaster are great, because then if you're casting your Colossal Dreadmaw on turn five, it's just awesome. And frequently with double Otapec Huntmaster, like I was able to play, like, it just makes you curve out and put a lot of pressure on your opponent with big bodies, like backed up by removal and combat tricks. And the big body, like this Sure Strike shines in this deck because your opponent's often going to have to be double blocking your creatures. So it just turns it into a 2-for-1.
Yeah, that all makes sense. That puts it in a really nice perspective. Thank you. All right. So the next thing we want to sort of talk about, which isn't maybe quite like an archetype in terms of a tribal one in this format, but it is one that is very strong, is blue based one with the wind aggro decks.
I'm so sad to let this secret out to the world. Well, I feel like we've had it all to ourselves for a couple weeks.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how the format eventually adjusts. But at least in the intermediate pleb queues, the one with the wind decks are still very, very viable, and the card is going much later than it should. You and I have one with the wind pegged as one of the best commons in the format, and it really shines here, mostly because the deck doesn't need to be tribal to be good, and it pairs with any color. So what this deck is trying to do is have as many one with the winds as you can get, and as many ways to protect those one with the wind creatures as you can get, like Dive Down and Siren Storm Tamer. Those are the two big ways that you can protect your creatures with one with wind. So Dive Down is the blue mana instant that gives your creature you control hexproof and +0/+3 until end of turn. So it's like a fine combat trick just on its own that you could just play one of in any deck. But the fact that it gets to protect your creature that you, your opponent's like so excited to 2-for-1 you because you've made the quote unquote mistake of playing an enchantment on your creature and you just go, nope, one mana. Protected, sorry. And Siren Storm Tamer is the one blue mana 1/1 flyer that has the activated ability of one mana, sacrifice it to counter a spell that targets you or a creature you control. So it does a good impression of Dive Down.
I cannot tell you the number of times I've had my opponents concede to me casting Dive Down in this format.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
because the removal is so clunky and you just can't really take a lot of it, your opponent probably has the one shot at dealing with it. Like, you've suited up your creature with one with the wind. God forbid it's something like Bishop Soldier that's gaining you 4 life a turn. And they go, okay, I finally got it. I have Raid and I'm casting Fire Cannon Blast. And you just go, Dive Down. That's it. That was their chance to deal with that card, and you protected it. So it's really important to do that. I'm basically on having a pretty equal ratio. If I'm leaning like slightly less on the Dive Downs to the one with the winds, but like if I've got 2-1 with the winds, I'm pretty happy to have two copies of the protect spells, like some combination of Storm Tamers and Dive Downs. If I've got 3, I'm not mad about having 3, though 2 will be fine, etc. But I'm on a sort of even ratio there. So we can look at the ways that these blue decks pair with each other color. So certainly blue and green, that's going to be an aggro merfolk deck that's not mad at all about having one with the wind. It's already got River Herald's Boon doing a similar impression as one with the wind, but you're happy to have a lot of copies of both of those cards if you've got a good critical mass of creatures as well. A blue-black deck is going to also take advantage of Mark of the Vampire being, you know, not as good as One with the Wind because it's 4 mana, not 2 mana, but the fact that you gain lifelink from Mark of the Vampire puts it in that enhancement category that we talked about in Beard pretty solidly. Being able to race, because a lot of this format comes down to racing, with something like Mark of the Vampire on one of your creatures is really going to make combat kind of tough for your opponent to navigate. And certainly a card like Wanted Scoundrels, which is the one in a black for the 4/3 pirate that when it dies, your opponent gets 2 treasures. We talked about how there are like there's a 5 mana 3/2 in red, right?
Yeah.
A 5 mana 3/2 in red in Stormfleet Pyromancer. Wanted Scoundrels is 2 mana for a 4/3.
Do you remember when I said this card wasn't good?
I think you gave it a D, right?
I did. I'm so embarrassed.
Yeah.
I'm so ashamed. Mostly because I do think like the drawback would be worse than a different format if there were better cards to ramp into, but it turns out there's just not very many good cards to ramp into in the format. Mm-hmm. This card's just a house.
Yeah,
I am first picking this card often.
Yeah, I mean, what were we talking about today? We were talking about Settle the Wreckage versus...
Khinjali's Sunwing.
Khinjali's Sunwing versus this. It's pretty close.
Yeah, I picked this, and I wasn't very unhappy about it.
Yeah, it's a great card. If you're pairing blue with red, you're going to be taking advantage of red having a weaker cousin of One with the Wind in Swashbuckling, which is the one in a red for the enchantment, +2/+2, and haste to a creature. And then you're just looking for as many one drops and two drops as possible. So like then you've got Fire Shrine Keeper as red's common one drop menace, 1/1. Frenzied Raptor, God forbid you have Frenzied Raptor with a One with the Wind on it. That's going to be a 6/4 cracking in the air. And then blue-white, which is sort of a favorite deck of ours, especially because it's been so heralded by Ryan Sachs, who has helped us out both with navigating this format. Blue-white aggro might be just one of the best decks in the format, if not the best deck. Plopping a One with Wind onto a Bishop Soldier, that's the 2/2 with lifelink, or a Territorial Hammerskull to tap things down, or an Andanto Vanguard, which is just like game over, basically. All of those creatures are really, really strong with One with the Wind backed up with some sort of blue tempo or a Pious Interdiction from white. So ways that you can get into this deck are certainly One with the Wind. Siren Storm Tamer is, I think, a card that has just gone up and up in value. Again, that's the 1-mana 1/1 flyer that protects creatures. Dive Down is, at least currently, not a card you need to take very highly. Like, I value this card a lot, but I have to sort of stop myself from taking its sixth pick if I'm, like, grabbing One with the Winds, because I know I can get them later. So be aware if you're wheeling them, because that's going to be just a good reinforcement that you're in the right seats. And then looking at good bounce and tempo, Perilous Voyage, Water Trap Weaver, these are going to be the most efficient things. I mean, Water Trap Weaver and Hammer Skull are really strong in this deck, especially because it's ways that you're basically doing two things. You're, like, adding creatures to the board and then tempoing your opponents out by not letting them block, and having some amount of bounce to set your opponent back with Perilous Voyage, Depth of Desire, and Run Aground, I think are all really important things to do.
Yeah, and this deck's really strong, and I think the biggest strength of this deck is that it is flexible. It doesn't rely on tribal synergies, and it's pretty easy to draft if you're seeing One with the Winds. It's tough without One with the Winds. There's also a version of the deck that's black-red that I think Christian Calcano featured at Worlds that relies more on Swashbuckling and Mark of the Vampire, but this deck right here is its own archetype, and it's based around the enhancements we talked about with Beard. So, and I think those four cards are Pirate's Cutlass, One with the Wind, Mark of the Vampire, and Swashbuckling, and that's where the E in Beard comes from, and it's a huge force in this format, and I think... like, this is the sort of deck that I default to if I haven't identified a tribe that's open in my seat.
Yeah. This is, I think, that E in enhancements from Beard is the biggest thing that makes this format so tough, is because we have just, as good limited players, you have so ingrained in yourself that auras are bad. You're setting yourself up for two-for-ones. You're investing things in, like, building up creatures, and that can set yourself up to get out-tempoed later in the game, and that's just not the case here. Because the creatures are so weak, those enhancements are the things that are going to let you power through the rest of the game.
Right. Removal's not good, enhancements are, and the revert. I think that's why you and I were struggling in the format in the beginning, because we were taking removal highly, and we were like taking One with the Winds and Mark of the Vampires, but not nearly as aggressively as we are now, and I think we were way overvaluing the clunky 5-drop removal.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you'll just stick with Beard, the bombs, so it's bombs, enhancements, aggro, and then cheap removal, preferably maybe one copies of an expensive removal spell, and then dudes, just cheap dudes.
Yeah.
That's the secret to success in the format.
For sure.
So before we head out here, we're going to re-rank the top commons.
Yeah. So before we get into any colors, we just got to shout out Pirate's Cutlass as probably the best common in the format. Maybe not like pound for pound on power level, but certainly on pack one, pick one, you're guaranteed to play it in your deck, and it's going to be good in your deck.
Right, and it's not going to go in every deck. Like, if you're, you know, in pack two of the draft, you might pass a Pirate's Cutlass, and that's okay.
Sure.
But pack one, pick one, it's a house.
Yeah.
All right, white, we've got number one, and this is maybe a little controversial, Bishop Soldier. That's one and a white for the 2/2 vampire with lifelink. The card's just great. It does it all. plays aggro well, it plays defense well, it prevents your opponent from attacking you because they're going to get cracked back by a 2-2 lifelinker, and it's kind of the headliner card in One with the Wind, kind of are their own deck, like that blue-white aggro deck with One with the Wind. Mm-hmm. And then second, we've got Territorial Hammer Skull, and certainly a lot of people are going to have Territorial Hammer Skull number one. I've been picking Bishop Soldier over Territorial Hammer Skull. I think it's the two. I think your three-drop slot gets a little clogged, and I think Bishop Soldier is the best two-drop in the format.
Yeah.
At common, certainly. And even runs with a lot of the best uncommons, too. So Territorial Hammer Skull, second. And then Pious Interdiction, third. That's three and a white for the enchantment. That's the pacifism effect that gains you two life when it enters the battlefield. And I think that two life gain tacked onto there makes this quite a lot better.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's a little clunky at four mana, but that two life gain really helps make up for the tempo loss.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't actually know, but I think a lot of our rankings are going to be pretty controversial with the broad scope of this format. So in blue, surprise, surprise, we talked about an entire archetype being built around this card. One with the Wind is our top common in blue. And then we've got Water Trap Weaver behind that. That's the 2-2 blue 2/2 merfolk that when it comes into play, taps a creature, it doesn't untap until its opponent's next untap step, or it doesn't untap in its opponent's next untap step. And at three, we've got Shaper's Apprentice. That's the 1-1 blue for the 2/1 merfolk that if you control another merfolk, it has flying. So again, we're just like valuing. You can see it right here. Enhancements first, aggro next, and then just cheap dudes last. Blue doesn't really have access to removal, unfortunately, at least in the cheap variety. It has got some bounce and run aground, Perilous Voyage and Depths of Desire, but that doesn't compete with what we've got here.
No, and I went through this weird progression with One with the Wind where I felt like guilty about playing it.
I did too.
And then I was like, okay, this is just good, but like I still wouldn't put it the best blue common, but like I knew it was really good. And then I got to the point where I was just like, you know what? Screw it. This card's awesome. I'm taking it. I'm first picking it. It just is. It's just the best blue common.
Yeah, and one of the best commons, period.
But it, like, I think you went through that same progression. It was just like weird how that went.
It just feels like it goes against every fiber of my limited being to go, you know what's the best blue card in the format is a stupid enchantment.
It's not stupid, though. It's so good. It wins games.
Great. Yeah.
It wins games. All right, on to red. Our best red common, and this is probably also controversial. Fathom Fleet Firebrand, 1 red for the 2/2 pirate that's got smoke breathing. Fire Cannon Blast, that's the 1 red, deal 3 damage to our creature, and if you've got Raid, it deals 6. And then Tilinale's Knight, 3rd, that's 1 red for the 2/2 human knight that gets +1/+1 when it's attacking if you control a dinosaur. So 2/2 drops there, and the Fire Cannon Blast.
Yeah, I mean, we've got, again, it's going in the exact same order of Beard. There's no bombs, there's no enhancements here. We don't have Swashbuckling in the top 3 yet, but that might happen in the next few weeks. But we've got aggro and Fathom Fleet Firebrand, we've got cheap removal and Fire Cannon Blast, and we've got dudes in Tilinale's Knight. Moving on to black, we still got Vanquish the Weak at number 1. It's held true, though it is no longer our favorite common overall of the format. That's the 2 black for the instant that destroys target creature with power 3 or less. So this does kill most commons in the format. I think a knock against it is that you can get blown out with pump spells. Your opponent can, like, save their creature with a pump spell or a trick like that. But it's also just like, you want to be, again, what we said at the beginning of the format is, or the beginning of the episode is, you want to be the one posing the questions, not the one needing to come up with the answers.
The other knock against it is that it doesn't hit something that's suited up with One with the Wind or Pirate's Cutlass.
Right.
Like, if they've already landed that, it doesn't help you solve that problem.
Oh, such a good point. Yeah, for sure. And then, this is sort of a cop-out, but I do think they're so neck and neck. Tied for 2 is Skullduggery and Skymarch Bloodletter. And I think this is just really varies where you are in the draft and what your deck looks like. So I think I'm on the Skymarch Bloodletter side of things, if this is like pack one, pick one.
Right, because it gives you the option to be vamps, and it's just going to go in any black deck.
And also, I want to pose the questions. I want to put the 2/2 flyer in play rather than have the removal spell / combat trick in my hand waiting for something to target it with. So I think Skymarch Bloodletter just edges out Skullduggery ever so slightly for me. But at a certain point in the draft, if I've already got a couple Bloodletters and then I see a Bloodletter versus a Skullduggery, I'm going to grab the Skullduggery. So that's where that like is a sort of conversation with the pile of cards you have. And then third, we have Contract Killing, sort of like, I think, begrudgingly or by default. Like, you're going to want, I think, certainly, you want one catch-all removal spell in your deck if you can have one, if that's a contract killing, if that's a walk the plank, if that's a pious interdiction, an Ixalan's binding, that kind of thing. So contract killing is the 3BB, destroy target creature at sorcery speed, and then you get 2 treasures. So I'd like to know that my deck has access to one way to just, like, kill something if my opponent happens to have something like a Burning Sun's Avatar or a, I don't know, Hostage Taker, but they've probably already done the damage with Hostage Taker, or, you know, a Charging Monstrosaur, let's say. I want to know that I can kill Charging Monstrosaur if my opponent plays it. So that's why I think a contract killing still hangs out in the top three.
Yeah, and then on to green. This is going to show our bias here towards green wanting to be Merfolk. Number one, we've got River Herald's Boon. That's the one in a green for the instant that lets you put a +1/+1 counter on one target Merfolk and other target creature, or you can put both counters on the Merfolk if it's a Merfolk. I had an opponent type that in chat today to me. Like, I put 2 counters on one creature, and they were like, you can do that? And I was like, yeah, you can. Deeproot Warrior, that's one in a green for the 2/2 that gets +1/+1 when it gets blocked. And then Tashana's Wayfinder, 2 in a green for the 2/2 Merfolk that explores when it enters the battlefield. So 2 Merfolk there and an enhancement. And again, it's showing our beard thing. Enhancements, number 2. And then we've got, like, aggro, Deeproot Warrior. And then dudes, Tashana's Wayfinder says Merfolk on it. It's gonna help you hit lands. It's a good body. If it hits, it's a 3/3 for 3, which is great in the format. As you can see, our common rankings have changed a ton
drastically
since the set review, and I think this reordering is what has led to our success.
Ben, are you so excited? Pounce is not in the top 3.
I know, we got it out of there. I am excited. I pegged that card in the set review.
Do we have time to talk about a couple of these cards?
Yeah, let's do it.
I just want to talk about a few cards that I think are tempo negative. We were talking about this deck being so aggressive and you wanted to be so assertive, and there are a handful of cards that I think looked strong initially and just, like, really you don't have time for, or you need to be very wary of playing. And those cards are going to be Bonded Horncrest, which is the 3 in a red 5/5 dino that can't attack or block alone, and Storm Sculptor, which is the 3 in a blue for the 3/2 merfolk that when it comes into play, you have to return a creature to your hand and it's unblockable. Both of those cards are really dangerous things, I think, to put in your deck, because they set your opponent up to be able to craft game states where that card is dead for you. So certainly Bonded Horncrest, you can, like, you know, you have that in play in another creature and they remove that creature, or they tap it with Water Trap Weaver or Territorial Hammerskull, and now you thought you had 2 blockers and now you have 0 blockers. But that's your own fault because you've put this tempo negative card into your deck. Storm Sculptor, very similarly, if you can sort of craft the state of, like, oh, I want to curve out, I want to go 2-drop, 3-drop, but then my 4-drop makes me rebuy my 3-drop. And you can talk yourself into, oh, but I have Water Trap Weaver, I have Jade Guardian, I have these Enter the Battlefield effects that I want to rebuy. But that Storm Sculptor is really negatively impacting the tempo on yourself.
Ain't nobody got time for that in this format.
Nobody has time for that, exactly. And things like these sort of, like, utility creatures like Blossom Dryad and Rummaging Goblin, though I think there are sort of niche homes for both of these cards in general, these are not the things you want to be doing because these are creatures that you're playing that aren't actually affecting combat, and this format is based entirely around combat. So investing mana in things that don't impact combat or impact the creatures on your opponent's side of the board are not things you want to be doing.
Your Rummaging Goblin getting picked off by Skullduggery feels horrific.
Yeah. I mean, it feels horrific, but it's also like, well, he wasn't blocking anyway, so I don't know if I really care about it getting killed. But yeah, it's just terrible. So those are just the handful of cards I wanted to talk about, just because I know that we had a Horncrest pretty high in the set review. We had Storm Sculptor. I had that in my top 3 in the set review, so just wanted to throw those out there.
Yeah, a few cards for me. Bishop of the Bloodstained, I'm just pretty down on that card. Mm-hmm. We kind of hit on that in the Vampire section. Anointed Deacon is just so much better. A card that people seem to be high on that just hasn't been good for me ever is Ranging Raptors.
Yeah.
The card's powerful, and it seems like it should go into, like, a multicolor control deck. I just think that multicolor control deck's not good in the format. Ergo, like, Ranging Raptors isn't good, despite the fact that it's a powerful card.
I also think the multicolor control deck probably wants to be blue-based with treasures.
Blue-based, yeah, with and treasures, not like blue-black. Yeah, yeah. And then another card that I see people playing all the time that I just don't think is very good is Khanjali's Caller, the single white mana for the 0/3 that makes your dinosaurs cost 1 less. I don't think there's room in this format for a card that, like, doesn't really do anything, because that card doesn't even really block a lot of the 2-drop commons.
Right, that not attack the good ones. Doesn't block Deeproot Warrior, it doesn't block Fathom Fleet, it doesn't, like, Bishop Soldier, you're still gaining 2 life when you attack with it. Like, it's not doing a lot.
Yeah, it just doesn't impact the board enough, and unless you just get the nuts curve out, like, it's really not worth a card slot. So I'm pretty down on that one. Those are a few of the cards I wanted to hit.
Great.
All right. That episode is it. That's what we know.
we bore our souls for you all on this podcast.
Yeah. And huge shout out again to Ehe Dude and Ryan Sachs. I'll try and link. Ryan wrote an article this week in Star City Games that has so a lot good. Of this information. I'll link it in the show notes. I'll try to find it and link it in the show notes. If you want to see, like, if you're more of a visual person, you need to go read Ryan's article.
Yeah.
And he I think, differs maybe slightly from some of the stuff on us still, because every once in a while, even now, like, he disagrees with me on draft picks. But I think, by and large, we're in line with what he has showed us.
I just want to also shout him out, because I love the thing about him that I love is that he's clearly very smart. He clearly has a good handle on this format, but he's never, it's not black and white for him. It's not, I'm right, you're wrong. He's always open to, like, oh, interesting. Or, like, you should probably take what feels right for you. And, like, every drafter is different. And I think he has a really, like, open, subjective way of looking at the format that is a pretty big breath of fresh air from how a lot of the Magic community views draft picks.
Yeah, it's always in my opinion. And Ehe Dude's always in my humble opinion.
Yeah. I think that's like probably why they're so good.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why we're, like, listening to them, too. Because they're obviously smart, and they're not critical, and they're open to discussions. And Ryan, too, even now, is like, yeah, this is what I think, but a lot of people don't think this. Or mm-hmm. this is what I think, and you don't have to think it either, but it's what's working for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both very open-minded people. So, yeah, go take this and go win some Ixalan drafts. Both our win rates are around 70% since we've been employing this stuff.
And give us some feedback. Like, let us know what's working for you, what's not working for you, where you differ. Do you have different pick orders? Do you have cards that you think we've missed or overlooked? We'd love to know that.
Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen. And a reminder, we've got our Ixalan treasure hunt going on. You can tweet at us and tweet at Lords of Limited, or if you're not on Twitter, you can email us screenshots at lordsoflimited@gmail.com. We've got 14 of them crossed off. There are only 4 remaining. One is infinite looping your opponent with Sanguine Sacrament. One is make Tashana's Voice of Thunder a 10-10. One's mill your opponent out with Overflowing Insight. Can't remember what the fourth one is. It's based around a mythic. It's another mythic. It's all the ones that are based around mythics that are left. So there's 4 left. I've posted that on Twitter. I'll make another post on Twitter probably tomorrow with an update for that. Generation D20 is already locked for the giveaway for 5 packs. We've got a lot of other people that are close to getting 5 done. I've done 3. I think you've done 1 at least.
Yeah, I've only done 1. I guess came so close to getting equal employment.
Oh yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah, that was hilarious.
The other one we're missing is Cockroaches Will Survive. Have a creature survive Star of Extinction.
Ooh, yeah, there it is.
Yeah, so be sure to finish that off. I really want to be able to do an 18-hour stream with you.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, where can people find us? You can connect with us on Twitter. I am at Lord Tupperware. Ben is at Mr. Metronome. You can catch us streaming on Twitch. I am at twitch.tv/LordTupperware. Ben is at twitch.tv/Mr. Metronome. Mr. is spelled out. I also have a YouTube channel. I have 6 Ixalan drafts up there. We also have, thank you to everyone who's subscribed. The shout-out for subscribers 2 weeks ago really worked. Pushed me over the edge for 100 subs on YouTube. And we now have a URL, YouTube. slash.com/c/LordTupperware. Really, really catchy, I know. So be sure to check that out and let me know what you think.
Yeah, if you've got any feedback about the show or questions for us, send us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. See you later.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.